Hello and welcome everyone to episode 5 of the Odds and End podcast. And today we have Doug Campbell with us. Doug is the CEO of Insight Prediction, which is a prediction market. We'll link it in the show notes, who mainly do do a lot of geopolitical markets, certainly comparable to their size. They're a good one there. And also Doug is an associate professor, and I've told him he can shill any market he likes, but he has to give a prediction on it. So I think we'll get some actual numbers out of him, which will be good. And if you disagree and you don't have a gambling problem, which I think is a serious problem for some people, so you shouldn't do it if you do. But if you don't have a gambling problem, then you can disagree with him and you can put your money where your mouth is. Doug, it's lovely to have you this morning or this afternoon, whenever it is for you. I don't understand.
It's my pleasure. I'm a big fan of your podcast. I think I saw the last one. Very interesting stuff.
Thanks. Let's just jump into it. Doug, yep. I believe you have some opinions on Ukraine. Let's hear them. You tell me, I'll type. For anyone who can't see, we have video I put on YouTube, and I think Spotify does video as well these days. But you can sort of see the probability like map as I build it. But I will try and speak things out as well if you just like to listen. And, by all means, try and give me feedback via DMs or something. So, what do you think? What do you know a lot about on this stuff, Doug?
So I guess my favorite market that I've been kind of obsessed with the last few months is a market about, will Ukraine cut the land bridge to Crimea? And there's a few markets out on Insight Prediction. We have one that goes until September 30th. Metaculus, of course, has one at the end of the year. I think at Insight Prediction, we're going to put up probably within the next week or so, another market either that has a year-end deadline or maybe a March 30th deadline, and might also do a long-term market. And so why I think this is an interesting question is because, you know, if we're not going to get just a stalemate result whereby, you know, maybe there's never really peace, it's just maybe at some point kind of the lines stabilize, maybe the fighting dies down, you know, in some periods, and maybe at other times it kind of livens up a little bit. If we're not going to get a stalemate, the way we're not going to get a stalemate, or one of the primary ways, I think, is that Ukraine will storm south, they'll cut off the land bridge to Crimea. And at that point, I actually think that they would have a bit of a bargaining chip to definitively end the war, right? And so that's a controversial take. There's been some people, Michael Kaufman, who said, you know, even if they're successful at cutting the land bridge, there's no guarantee that the Russians will just stop the war, stop attacking, or even if Ukraine pushes Russia all the way out of Ukraine. Now, Russia might just continue the war out of spite, but I do think if Ukraine cuts the land bridge, they will then have a bargaining chip, which is that Putin does not want to lose Ukraine or Crimea.
Right. So your opinion is, just to clarify, that they hold Crimea in this position, and then they trade back off Crimea, maybe for some of the land they've lost. I don't know. Do you have a view on how much?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess there was, I kind of missed the news when it came out, but apparently there was kind of some earlier discussion about Russia moving back to its 2014.
So Russia keeps Luhansk, Donetsk, and Crimea.
So basically Russia would keep the land it took in 2014. It would keep Crimea and part of Donbass. It would give back everything else. There would be peace. You know, probably what would happen is some of the funds of the Russian central bank that got frozen would probably be given to Ukraine in this case. it's not Russia's to give anymore in any case. And so you can imagine kind of a sustainable peace on that basis. So I know, of course, Ukraine would like to take back Crimea. Crimea is a majority Russian. So I don't know that that's a good idea necessarily for long-term peace, right?
Let's try and pin this down a bit. So you're saying, I mean, what, you know, hopefully they're within the bounds of their own market, so you're not giving people information here. But what's your thoughts on this, on the Crimea land bridge by the 30th?
So I'm pessimistic. And I mean, so right now, my thoughts are exactly what you can see in our markets, right? That it's somewhere between maybe 8 and 11 cents. I think it's definitely long shot. It's an interesting long shot. And so I guess a question might be, you know, why is it a long shot? And I guess another question might be, Metaculus is now at 20% by the end of the year. And I guess there's a question whether I should think that the difference in these markets kind of is justified by the additional time period. And so I probably do not. And the difference would be justified is just because muddy season starts in October. I think probably Ukraine will kind of want to wind up its offensive, counteroffensive before muddy season starts. Also, at some point, and this is kind of one of the big doubts I always had about this question, is how much does it make, how much sense does it make for Ukraine to just attack right now, when at some point they're going to get F-16s, right? At some point they're probably going to get attack-ems. They're going to get range Polish missiles at some point. The French just decided to send more kind of longer range things. It was kind of always clear that they were going to get cluster munitions. Well, no, it wasn't always clear, but it was kind of seemed likely that they might get cluster munitions from the U.S. at some point. They're going to get these GLSTB bombs, were initially thought to be arriving from the U.S. in September. And so the question has always been, or one of the questions has always been, you know, how much sense does it make for Ukraine to just go on an all-out attack now, right?
Right. So let's try and pin some of this stuff. So you think that munitions are going to come too late. I've never done this before, but I'm just going to start putting probabilities in your mouth. And if you don't like them, I mean, sure, I don't know. Sure. We're going to see. So it seems to me that you think some sort of munitions will come too late for 2023.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know. Maybe you think that, like,
unlikely. I guess the F-6, from what I've heard, F-16s, they just started training on them in Denmark.
Earlier this year, right? The UK...
Yeah, unlikely they come really before December. Maybe they come sometime in December, maybe late November. But it seems unlikely they would come.
So maybe you're more confident than 60. Maybe you're comfortable. Maybe you're confident sort of 4 and 5, maybe. They're going to come.
Yeah.
There's not going to be some major munitions shift.
Right, because
you know, we're not going to get 1,000 tanks. We're not going to get.
No.
Okay. So you're at 10% on the land bridge. I mean, do you have thoughts on the Kursk Bridge? Do you think that's like an interesting part of the discussion? If you don't, you know, screw it. We'll just move on.
So I'll admit, I was very bullish. I kind of believed that, you know, when the offensive started, Ukraine would probably figure out one way or another to hit the Kursk Bridge. And they haven't. So I kind of think now it kind of seems a bit unlikely that they're going to hit it during this offensive or within the next couple.
So, I don't know. You think 30, 1 in 3 maybe?
During this offensive? No, I would say maybe more like 20% that they hit it. I think the reasons why are probably, I would suspect that the Brits probably told them not to do it with Storm Shadows. I guess Russia now is a little bit more meticulous in checking what goes over the bridge.
I don't know much about this, but my sense was that from what I could find, it was that they could if they wanted to with Storm Shadows, particularly now they've got the longer range French Storm Shadows, right? Well, I guess they haven't had those for a while, so maybe that's not. But once they've had those for a while, then certainly they will have been able to do it. And then, so you have to ask why they didn't. I guess that's one theory. Another theory I had was just that they want to save it for an opportune time. So maybe they want to do it at the end of this season as kind of like a look what we managed kind of a thing. But equally, they might want to keep it so that if they do actually cut the land bridge, then they can blow it up and then they can really put some pressure on Crimea as a better bargaining chip or as a something. I don't know if those stories make sense.
They did use a storm shadow to hit target another bridge on the north part of Crimea. And my sense is that it's kind of, they built a new pontoon bridge in less than a day. And, you know, I don't know what's going on with the repairs of that bridge, but probably they've already repaired it or have soon.
Right.
The pontoon bridge was easy to make. And so you really need to hit it with, you know, the pontoon bridge with a storm shadow each day. And they don't have that many storm shadows, actually.
Yeah, it seems.
And so something similar could be a worry with the Crimean Bridge. I suspect the Brits told them not to use storm shadows. If they did use storm shadows, I think they'd need to hit it a few times. At least, you know, the chat on the internet is that maybe they need to use more than one.
My sense was, from what I saw, I watched some videos on this, and it seemed like once you can take them out of the air, which if they're going for a long distance, you might be able to. You don't really have confidence that you're going to actually blow the bridge up. You might want
just 10 or 20. Right.
You know, and at that point, it just may not be worth it as an objective compared to how valuable those are.
If you don't mind, let's go back and talk about what some relevant base rates might be for the land bridge.
So one
thing I've noticed is kind of interesting, like a general principle, is that most things in this war, you know, especially looking at the historic markets on Insight Prediction, most things do not happen, right?
Yeah. So
let's just start with the base rate.
Do you know your base rates? Because obviously there's this sort of famous fact that, well, I think Scott Alexander quotes this, I don't know if he did the research, but that on Metaculus, about 33% of the time do things happen. Do you know what percentage on Insight things happen? What percent?
I guess it would be less than 20%, actually.
Right. On Insight Predictions, about 20% of the time, it happens every time.
Yeah. So I would put it below 20% just based on that.
Right. Okay, interesting.
So then the other caveat, the second part of this, is that most things that do happen, happen after the first market that Insight Prediction makes about an event.
Right.
In fact, it might be the case that 100% of historic markets we made about some event that happened after the first market. So the only caveat to that is when Russia invaded Ukraine. That happened in the first market. So some unexpected things do happen. And so just going back through the history, thinking about this, we made markets on Will. You know, we were kind of bullish on after Russia changed its focus to taking Donbass after April of 2022. We had some markets on, you know, will Russia take all of Donbass? That didn't happen. Will Russia just take all of Luhansk Oblast? And that also did not happen. Even though they did take all of Luhansk Oblast, it just hadn't happened by, you know, the end of the second market. It happened maybe the day after. The source we were using updated their market. I think it was even a few hours after our market finished that they updated the map to show that Russia had control of all of Luhansk Oblast. And that was in a situation where it wasn't very much territory. You know, we had a lot of reason to think that Russia would take that territory. They were making progress each day. And even then, when you had all these factors together, it didn't resolve in time to satisfy the market. I think you also participated in the Kherson market.
Yeah, in fact, the best I've ever done on a market.
Yeah, I remember that one. And I believe it was our third Kherson market that finally resolved yes. So that was a 1 out of 3 type of scenario. In addition, we had markets on will Ukraine take Izum? And then finally they did. But I'm not sure if that was the first or second market we had on that question. We had another, I think, 3 markets on will Russia take Bakhmut by X and X date? And I think we had 2 markets or maybe 3 markets on this question, or maybe even 4.
Just obviously it's not obviously. My sense is you like having these shorter term markets, but
so what we discovered when I started doing this, we had mostly long term markets. But some of the feedback we got from bettors is that they don't like long-term markets. They like the short-term markets.
Yeah.
So what you end up getting with this relative to Metaculus is a bunch of shorter-term markets that potentially have a large payoff if you hit them correctly. So you take a kind of, you have long odds. But, you know, of course, if you bet now on the land bridge by September 30th, potentially you can get a 10-to-1 return or something on the order of that. So that's why we do it. And actually, we probably should have more longer-term markets in there. Some people do like betting on them, and I think there's this kind of problem in that real money prediction markets have, in that long-term markets have, because of capital costs, tend to be a little bit incorrectly priced. So we've thought about how to solve that, but it's a discussion for another time.
I mean, probably anybody who's listening to this podcast is happy to have this discussion. So, I mean, let's just blitz through it. I mean, my sense is that the best solution or the solution that most people suggest is either some kind of you can use something other than fiat, right? You can maybe use some kind of like you can invest your money into, you can have markets on indexes, for instance, like the S&P 500 or something. And
So,
then you're much more happy to leave it for long periods. Though one of my
exactly.
very clever friends who I defer to sort of suggests that Polymarket or one of them, Augur or something, they had it on crypto assets. And therefore, you'd imagine that many of these people who are levered to the hilt on crypto assets would have been very happy to have bet using those same assets for long periods of time. And they weren't. And his sort of suggestion was actually people like keeping these things kind of separate. And that his expectation was that even if you had these index markets, then maybe you wouldn't see. I guess maybe an alternative suggestion is people can have some kind of like margin call type thing where they can have positions on a load of long-term markets and then like they can effectively sort of leverage on those long-term markets, but if they ever go under, then they lose all their winnings elsewhere or something. Though,
Right. I think both of these ideas are very interesting. And so actually we do have some markets in Bitcoin and Ethereum. And just like you said, they didn't get that much volume. And then then it was like, from our perspective, it was like another market where we had to spend time, updating, providing and updating the liquidity. We might go in the future do more of these Bitcoin and Ethereum markets, but they weren't as popular. They weren't an immediate hit.
They weren't
What we wanted
okay.
to do before, and we might do this in the future. It's just, I'm taking a risk in terms of the current regulatory environment in the U.S. Even though in the U.S. we block U.S. IP addresses, so it's just inside predictions open internationally. We also block Russian IP addresses, but we were thinking about having where you'd buy like a SPY coin, the S&P 500 ETF, and then denominate markets in terms of an ETF, S&P 500 ETF. And so at least you would, in expectation, you'd get the S&P 500's 7% appreciation over time. I mean, I also think that, like, I'm not a Bitcoin bro, but like to have 1% of your wealth in Ethereum or Bitcoin, I think makes some sense given on what we've seen.
So to sort of round that off, you don't have those are your suggestions. You don't have some other magical suggestion. It seems like even the options that people have are a little bit unideal. Like it just is a problem that long-term prediction markets, are, the longer term they are, the less advantageous they are.
Right. But
I'm briefly going to take a moment.
you can always make a little bit of adjustments for this. But yeah, adjusting markets for negative risk. Just one second.
So Doug's had to go away briefly, but we might as well use this time for me to do what I was going to do, which was to shill Metaculus. I think it's generally underrated amongst particularly sort of prediction markety people that Metaculus just works. And so like it has other problems. What it trades off for in terms of its long-term predictions being sort of functional and well incentivized, that it might have more prediction markets than you would expect, or you don't have a way to like have large liquidity or small liquidity markets. Like prediction markets, because everything is denominated in money, the benefit is if you want a market to be big, somebody has to pay for it. So you can't just like endlessly spam markets because that has cost. So one might think that Metaculus has too many markets, But the benefit of that is that they, I was just doing a sort of a monologue-y bit, Doug, but just basically to, I don't know if I'll include it, but, and by all means, tell me when you're like ready to be back. But my monologue-y bit was just basically to say, I think prediction market bros tend to underrate, I think, the forecast aggregators, because until you're at real scale, it's not beneficial for people to do this as their whole job. It's not beneficial right. for people to be doing this, you know, to be eking out 3 percentage points or whatever. And so you actually do get a lot of the benefit by just saying, well, this is a prestige-based system. You get to say that you're cleverer than the other guys on this site. And that is, you know, meticulous. I think that's what the folks there. I know some really clever people who use that. And, you know, one of my friends, she says, oh, prediction market's the only way to go, that everything else has bad incentives. And I think that might be true when you're talking about prediction markets of like tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. But for right. many of the questions we talk about, I am like, I imagine that Metaculus does about as well as Insight. Though, you know, if you've got data on that, then I'd be interested.
Yeah. So I think we've just been talking, just to follow up on that. Like, I think you also mentioned like combining markets together and doing negative risk. And I think this is something that could be done. The other thing is, if you have a long-term prediction market that, say, it's at 95%, you know, you don't need to take the 95% literally. You can actually, you'd want to extremize that in a little bit. And this is also true of just actual prediction markets like Metaculus. So, you know, the Good Judgment Project guys, the way that they beat the CIA was that they took their estimates, if I have this correctly, and then they applied some kind of extremizing formula to it. And so, you know, if the probability of something is 99%, I think this is why it happens. I don't think they explain this clearly. My view is kind of like, you know, if you have an event, the prediction market says it's 99%, and, you know, maybe like 5% of the predictors are just noise, random noise. On average, that random noise is probably going to be less than 99%. And so I think that causes some kind of a bias. Whereas if, you know, the noise that thinks it's more than 99%, they can only be off by 1%. But the part of the noise that thinks it's less than 99%, they can be wrong by 99%.
So what you're saying is sort of, yeah. we should take 95% as more serious than 95%. You know, we should sort of consider that those high probabilities are actually much higher than they seem.
Exactly. So if something's at 95%, and especially if it's a long-term market, I mean, these are kind of two different things. One thing is that, you know, if there's a market for tomorrow and the odds are 95%, it should be 99%. If there's a market, or maybe if it's 95%, it resolves tomorrow, it should probably be like 97 or 98%. So there's a caveat to that, but this isn't prediction markets, not betting markets, I would say. There's a difference. For a betting market that's, you know, with a resolution in 2 years and it's at 95%, it should probably be like 99.5%, just for capital cost reasons, because nobody is going to buy that at 95% just because of, for capital cost reasons. So yeah, so I think that's, but how much should you adjust these markets? I think you could work this out with data.
Sort of saying, and again, I apologize if some viewers this isn't, but I feel like our core audience will be absolutely happy to have this discussion. So I'm just mm-hmm. taking the utilitarian approach here, you know, skip yep. forward 5 minutes if this is not your jam. But you're sort of saying that you might have like a little applet beside the market saying, you know, this is what you should see as the ground truth implied by the numbers here.
Exactly. You could back this
out. Just as sometimes betting markets add up to over 100%, and I often would appreciate if they would have alongside that, I say, well, here's the odds you're buying at, but you know, if you're using implied this as an information source, here is what is implied. Then,
yeah,
okay.
So the caveat to that is in betting markets. So of course, there's like the famous long shot bias in horse racing that, you know, the long shot horses are usually the odds are usually too high, actually, because somebody wants a 10-to-1 payoff. But when you have head-to-head matchups where, you know, the odds are more like maybe 60-40 or 70-30 or even 80-20, I think you tend to see, if anything, the opposite, that there's kind of a favorite bias, where, people tend to put too much money on what they see as kind of the overwhelming favorite in this case. And so, I think it's the difference is just, what the total odds kind of sum to, in this case. So if it's a very long shot, then it's different from, and there's no favorite. So in a horse race, the top horse is probably trading at like 30% or something. So you don't have this kind of overwhelming favorite, the New York Yankees playing some, minor league team. People are going to want the free 2% payoff, too much. And so we might actually see, and so it just depends what the data says. I actually don't know the answer to this question, with prediction markets. And so it might be that, extreme risk sometimes isn't priced, the risk of very low probability events isn't priced super well, just because it's difficult. But so if we can go back actually to what I was going to suggest, is we go back to like the finishing, thinking about the base rates of Ukraine taking the land bridge. So yeah, so there's the reasons to be pessimistic. Most markets resolve no. Most things that do happen later than we thought they were going to happen. And this kind of looks like something that would a shoe that would fit this market so far. On the other hand, there's some reasons to be bullish in this market. So like another kind of base rate was that Ukraine took, or kind of they retook a bunch of territory around April of 2022. They then retook more territory in the Kharkiv offensive. I think that was in September of 2022. After that, they took a bunch of territory in Kharkiv. I think that was what, maybe in November, early November, late October of 2022. And so each time period, they kind of retaken more and more of their territory back. And so, as a general trend, you might have thought that that trend of Ukraine retaking more of its territory would continue. And so, that has also been kind of my thought as well. And in addition to that, this time around, the composition of kind of capabilities and war material between the two sides has shifted. There's reports about Russia is dusting off even older tanks and armaments. On the other hand, Ukraine did receive a bunch of NATO kit. They have a bunch of new capabilities that they did not have for the Kherson and the Kharkiv offensive. So with these Western infantry fighting vehicles, there's two things about them that make them probably superior to the Russian ones, and that's one that when they get hit, it seems like the crews mostly survive, and they have better night optics, so they can kind of fight at night. And so these are kind of like real advantages that Ukraine did not have before that they have now. In addition, there's some similarities at least between Kharkiv and Kherson and the fight for the land bridge, which is that, kind of before Kharkiv, you could find a lot of people pointing out that, Russia seemed kind of at a deficit in terms of manpower in Ukraine, and that maybe they should have mobilized. The optimal time to mobilize is yesterday. Now we've also heard some mentions that it pointed out that maybe Ukraine, or sorry, maybe Russia again is at a manpower shortage. There was a report that between January and May, Russia had suffered 100,000 casualties. They only mobilized 300,000 new troops. Probably they've taken a lot of casualties and kind of like career soldiers. So now, who's defending in Ukraine on the Russian side? I think it's a greater mix of mobilized soldiers versus career professionals. Another kind of difference between the Kherson offensive might be that actually a lot of these guys, sure, the mobilized soldiers have 9 months more experience fighting, but also the career guys and the mobilized soldiers are maybe 9 months more tired than they were when Kherson happened. And kind of the big advance in Kherson that the Ukrainians did have before the Russians withdrew was said to go against just a group of soldiers that had been on the front lines without any rotation for months and months. And, you know, just this week we had a Russian general complain, you know, who knows to what extent this is all true, but complain about the fact that a lot of the troops in Zaporizhia seem to have been there for a long time with no rotations, not enough backups, maybe not enough counter-battery support, and is unhappy with the way things are going. And so we get this picture that, you know, maybe there's some similarities that, you know, there's hints that Russia doesn't have a lot of troops and support or backup troops. The troops at the front seem to be somewhat tired, probably not very great morale. Of course, the problem is there, you know, war sucks. To fight trench warfare is not going to be fun. There's not going to be a scenario where you've got guys stuck on the front fighting trench warfare who are super happy with their situation, right? I mean, that's just not going to happen. And so probably also you've got a lot of guys on the Ukrainian side who are also tired. There's evidence that Ukrainians have also taken a lot of casualties. And so it's really hard to know exactly, just from these anecdotes that we're getting, it's very hard to know about the real state of forces on both sides, other than the information we get from who's taking which territory. That's kind of like real information. And recently, so far in this offensive, Ukraine has not taken very much territory, right? So Russia didn't take much territory in its offensive over the winter either, and it looks like maybe the amount of territory that Ukraine has taken in the last 6 weeks is maybe almost comparable already to what Russia had taken in some 5 or 6 months. Mm-hmm. But still, they haven't taken much. And so that's a real data point. You know, on the other hand, you might suggest my model for how this is always going to work would be something like in the Kherson situation, I think Ukraine was kind of running up against a brick wall for 3 or 4 weeks. Until they finally found kind of a weak link and were able to advance something like 20 kilometers overnight, and they kind of forced a Russian retreat in the northern part of Kherson. So it's always going to be the case that Ukraine is going to have to pound for a long time and then finally make an advance. And so, you know, now, I guess the news just came today that the first cluster munitions from the U.S. have arrived in Ukraine. And, you know, I think this, with these additional munitions, I mean, so I think experts think that actually this could kind of be a big deal in alleviating the Ukrainian artillery shortage. But the other part of this, though, is that Russia, during this counteroffensive, has been firing a lot of artillery that suggests that they're not about to run out of artillery. And they still have an advantage in overall number of artillery fired. And so, you know, another kind of big picture look at this is that Ukraine has an air power deficit and an artillery deficit. And despite these two things, it's trying to have a successful offensive against an opponent that has dug in, has laid millions of mines, and has been, know it's coming and is ready for it. And so that's just a difficult hurdle to ask. Despite all these reasons to think, be optimistic generally, it might just be that, look, it's very difficult to take territory against well-entrenched opposition who's laid a million mines, who, you know, doesn't care too much about casualties, who can kind of force their soldiers to continue to defend. And who actually has an advantage in artillery and electronic warfare, maybe air power, and so on and so forth. So
I think this. So for people who listen to our third podcast with Stephen Godofsky, Stephen sort of said that his view was that this war was just burning off the excess capability the excess munitions that Russia had from USSR. And that, like, he didn't think much was going to happen this year, but that, like, if things kind of got up to speed, then the Ukraine could start, like, pulling ahead in terms of having artillery. And that, I don't know, that seems to chime a bit with what you're saying. I guess
Oh, yeah.
I guess, it would be interested
Yep.
No, you respond first.
So I was going to say there's kind of one other perspective that I think is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. And so one is that, you know, I think my view is that the U.S. and the West, collectively, they have the capabilities to allow Ukraine to retake the land bridge at any point in time they really want to.
I think that's true.
And so I think my reading is that maybe some people within the Biden administration thought that Ukraine had enough and didn't need more stuff, and that maybe if they gave them more stuff earlier on, they would, you know, take all of Crimea and start World War III.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to the extent that Ukraine didn't have enough, I think the Biden administration, maybe other people in the West, are thinking, okay, let's send them more stuff and then see what happens.
Right. So
this could affect...
I mean, I have a medium-sized position on the land bridge market on Insight
as
for this
I.
reason, that I think people aren't taking into account what could change in the positive direction. I think one major breakthrough, one bridgehead, like, you know, if somebody turns around and goes, okay, we're just going to give you a really lot more vehicles, if Russia runs out, I think the downsides are well known and people are sort of saying, well, things are just going to continue as they are. But I think there is, I don't know, a 20 to 50% chance of really a lot more troops, capabilities this season. And right. then that to me takes me from, you know, 10% to sort of 15 or 20% before the... I still don't think it's going to happen, but I think there is like some chance.
Right, right, for sure. And so actually one of the things people, point out that like Kharkiv was not a very good parallel for the current offensive. One of the reasons that Kharkiv was successful, or some of the reasons that Kharkiv was successful, is because even the Russians... So the troops there were hollowed out. Even the Russian commanders seemed not to know... have any idea of the extent to which the troops in Kharkiv had actually been hollowed out, right? And so, you know, the commanders are basically the same. It's still Putin's in charge, basically, of the Russian army, kind of micromanaging decisions. And so that hasn't changed. So the kind of the people who are in charge, who are unaware of the extent to which Russian troops have been hollowed out in Kharkiv, are the ones that are still in charge today. And so to some extent, we have no idea if Russia has enough troops to defend or doesn't have the troops to defend. But based on the history, it's at least possible that they are really low on key stuff. And if just, you know, Ukraine gets the snowball rolling, maybe it'll roll faster. Of course, I think the Surovikin line, the defensive structures that Russia put into place, probably are sensible. And it's going to be tough to just roll through 20 kilometers of minefields quickly, but still, you know, I think there is a real possibility for things to fold. So the other interesting thing that we haven't discussed is either a river crossing or the reservoir. Ukraine, actually...
We've got Antonov here is like, you know, what do you think of the chance for bridgehead before the end of the year, significant bridgehead?
Well, I mean, they do have a bridgehead over Antonovsky. Yeah. It's just there's a question. It's not easy to get out of that bridgehead. But, you know, at the other hand, I guess, at Normandy, it took the Allies 12 weeks to break out of their bridgehead. And it's been like 2 weeks or something.
Yeah. I guess, so maybe we should say, like, will they break out of the Antonov bridgehead?
I think the kind of the professional view is that it's quite unlikely that they will.
I want your view, Doug.
My layman perspective is that I don't understand why they couldn't do it, right? It seems like perfectly plausible that they could.
Yeah, I agree.
But when I listen to people who are kind of experts who know more than me, they tend to pour cold water on this in a way which...
You're gonna give me one in five, one in
15%.
Okay.
So I think it's unlikely.
So let's just sort of cycle through these things. So,
Can I qualify that 15%?
Yeah, absolutely.
So if Ukraine breaks out somewhere else and Russia is forced to kind of move or starts to retreat, then it's going to happen, obviously. If there other things happen in a bad way, the front starts to collapse, I think that's the point when absolutely, they will break out of that bridgehead. But okay, I think so, 85% likely that something else will have to happen first, where Russia kind of starts to make a generalized retreat. But before they just break out there and nowhere else, I think is unlikely. 15%.
Okay, so, right. So maybe like cycle through these a bit. So, I've said major munitions will come too late for 2023. I've got it like at 80%. We sort of think major increases probably going to be too late for this year.
Let me qualify this by saying that, or just point out something else, which is that there's kind of like an incentive problem here. The West definitely wants Ukraine to attack and end the war. But then by promising more things or making it clear to Ukraine that more capabilities are coming a little bit later, they kind of reduce the rationale, incentive to just attack all out now. If they attack in 6 months instead, they're going to have F-16s. Yeah. They're going to have attack-ems probably. They're going to have more capabilities so they can attack with just fewer. On the other hand, Ukraine also has more to end.
If they don't demonstrate that they are willing to fight, then they may not get things, and there could be a change in U.S. leadership.
Exactly.
Europe could become less favorable. So they have to play a sort of a game of attempting to get the most bang for their sort of...
Exactly.
For their lives, so, as their citizens,
my view, I also have a yes position that I accumulated kind of early on, the first week of the offensive and before that. And my view, my view now is that I was always correct to be bullish, but because of the losses Ukraine's taking and all the promised new capabilities which are on their way, that Ukraine didn't really have an offensive incentive to go all out and cut the land bridge now, be damned whatever, casualties, just because, they could get, by waiting, they could get new capabilities they didn't have before. And this is like already somewhat, this view is already somewhat substantiated. And that now the U.S. is sending cluster munitions based on the view that the offensive hasn't lived up to the hype so far. And so there's a question to what extent this is because Ukraine's just not attacking with as much, pizzazz as they were in the first few days of the counteroffensive when they retook 8 villages, and how much of this is just because, maybe they've been beaten down and taken too many losses that are problematic ones.
Okay.
So
we think it's pretty unlikely, maybe like 30% or something, that the US gives a lot more, like literally this summer in the middle of this offensive. Is that fair?
Right. Yep.
But we're not gonna pin you down. Like, everyone's gonna get things wrong here. I mean, what do you think for a significant fortification breach in the next month of the Russian line, of the Russian sort of major line? That they get. They make a huge jump. They're sort of getting tens of kilometers past the front line.
Okay, let's make it 10 kilometers. I would say whether they go another 10 kilometers somewhere. So I guess the question is on the land bridge or anywhere? Because this is kind of another point I wanted to mention.
Anywhere. I mean on the land bridge side, yeah. North-south.
Okay.
Or I guess they can have the bridgehead as well, but not on the... on the eastern front.
I see. I would put this at about maybe 20%, something like this. So I think the big worry here, and one of my worries initially, why I wasn't as high as, say, 75% as Scott was because, there was always kind of a worry that maybe, if Russia was defending on the land bridge and had left kind of Luhansk sparsely defended, it might have made sense for Ukraine to just go for Luhansk, take a bunch of territory, declare victory, have it be kind of a PR disaster for Putin, you know, kind of to change the view that Russia's there inevitably if they took another chunk of retook another chunk of territory. And, you know, recently they've been having a lot of success in Bakhmut. Probably, you know, for PR reasons, Ukraine doesn't want this counteroffensive to be declared a disaster. And so if they actually just retake Bakhmut, from a PR perspective, they can, you know, that'll, if they retake Bakhmut, that's headlines all over the world that Ukraine is winning, you know.
And they retook with actual quite low losses, something which Russia absolutely spent just tons and tons of losses to be able to get. I think it is strange, you know, this is a sort of played out view, but I think it is strange how PR really seems to matter in this. I mean, maybe I've just been naive to not consider it, but like to really think, sometimes they are looking at their objectives and going, okay, like which, you know, it's not clear to me that Bakhmut is necessarily a really valuable place to take back.
No, but it doesn't.
If they can take it back relatively cheaply, then it does seem like a bit of a PR win.
Exactly. I think these kind of PR wins are important in war. You know, in the US Civil War, which is kind of like, I don't know that much about war, but I know a fair amount about the U.S. Civil War. And so, like, you know, the reason that Grant advanced before Shiloh is not because he necessarily thought it was a great idea, but because if he retreated, he was just kind of cognizant of how, you know, the northern media was going to play it if, you know, he had retreated, after Shiloh and before they took Vicksburg. And so he, you know, did this whole risky Vicksburg campaign just because he knew they needed a victory of some kind, just for kind of propaganda media reasons. And I think it's a legitimate reason why you should attack and put pressure. But, you know, in addition, it turned out that, you know, the Vicksburg campaign was wildly successful. And so if Ukraine does go out on an all-out attack for PR reasons, it could also turn out that actually good things just happen in that case.
So we think 10 fortifications break, you know, in the next month, pretty unlikely. So then I try to sort of make up some made-up numbers here for the, like, Antonov Bridge. And I sort of had, I don't know, like 15% if they don't make a breach, maybe like 50% if they do. So overall, like sort of 20-25% or something. Does that seem about right to you?
Oh, yeah, right. Oh, I see. So this the fortification breach is separate from Antonovsky, you're saying, right?
Yeah. So I'm sort of saying, like, you know, like if they breach the fortifications, it seems like you think, oh, it's much more likely that they push out from the bridgehead.
Antonovsky. Yes, exactly. If there's a breach, yeah, for sure that would go up to maybe 50% or something. If they get a real breach. So another thing, I guess, another possibility is that they might try a reservoir crossing.
Yeah.
And so I kind of lack the expertise to really put good odds on this. I think it's also unlikely, but clearly kind of a long-shot possibility. My early view was also that if Ukraine was going to do this, especially after, you know, it's been kind of hard. Clearly the counteroffensive has been kind of hard going. But if they were going to do it, probably they would need some kind of trickery to get there. And so, you know, some of the trickery could be either with a river crossing or a reservoir crossing. Like I said, experts on this are totally mixed. Some people think it's going to be very difficult. Others think it, I don't know, what's his name, Thomas Tyner? Thinks that it'll probably happen and that Ukraine has the capabilities with these kind of marsh boats provided by the UK and so forth. My view is also that this Thomas Tyner, he's kind of a very pro-Ukraine, overly pro-Ukraine. I think he's a little bit passionate, a little too passionate. And I suspect it's also very unlikely. I think it'd be difficult for a variety of reasons, and maybe the probability of a successful, or that Ukraine will even attempt a reservoir crossing of magnitude is probably low. I would also say 15%, throw out a number.
Okay, so...
successful, I probably, you know, probably not super successful, unless Ukraine is advancing elsewhere on the front is collapsing, Russia's pulling back troops, I think then they probably could risk something like this. So in the end, I think this is unlikely by September 30th, but it's interesting, and I don't think the odds are not zero. I don't think the odds should be much below 10%. And so, 10 to 12% probably is totally fair. I think odds of around 10% by September 30th, you know, if this happens, it's going to be surprising.
Reservoir crossing.
A reservoir crossing or just a cutting of the land bridge by any means possible. Yeah, okay. So
I mean, just to try and, you know, to pin, so I've sort of tried to bundle this, like, will Russia run out of fire artillery? Probably not. 20% maybe. Will Russian troops sort of break in some sense?
I think they will. I tend to think Russia will not run out of artillery.
And Russian troop break, you know, some sort of thing where they just, you know, the troops give way.
Right.
You know, happened in Kherson. Like they just weren't able to hold it.
Right. That is more probable. I think that the odds of this are kind of very similar with just the odds of Ukraine making a big breach or going 10 kilometers. And so can I pitch another market I have? So we also have a market on will Ukraine take one of these six key cities by September 15th? And that's currently about 30 to 38%, somewhere in the low 30s. These six cities don't include Bakhmut because when we made the market, Ukraine still held Bakhmut. But yeah, so if you click on the Russia-Ukraine thing. Ukraine retake control of Severodonetsk. And so this market is kind of like, will Ukraine make any significant progress anywhere along the front? By September 15th, you know, excluding Bakhmut, which is an important one. I think there's no Solodar in here. And so I was always kind of a lot more bullish on this question, probably before this kind of, I thought about Bakhmut, but, you know, if Ukraine takes more than 10 kilometers in any direction, except for maybe Bakhmut, this would resolve as a yes. And so I think this market encapsulates my bullishness about...
And you agree with the percentage, so this market's between 30 and 36%, and you endorse it.
If I didn't agree with any of the markets on my webpage, unless I'd just forgotten to update the odds, this is kind of my own view, or else I would tend to move the market.
Kelly be damned.
The caveat to that is that I'll only take so much risk. I mean, I would also like to have
Kelly,
my books
not be out. Damned. Right, okay.
Right?
Sure.
I would like to balance my books on average. So there's a limit to, you know, when I was younger, maybe I took more risks than I do in my old age. So I'm only willing to risk so much money on a market, but usually I do push in the direction where I think the odds are favorable.
Okay, so then, I don't know, I mean... I also tried to just pull out so some stuff like, you know, maybe land bridge next year. I sort of had like half and half. It seems like you're pretty uncertain there. The Kerch bridge this year, pretty unlikely. You think maybe 20%?
Yeah, I think it's probably. I think land bridge. I would go land bridge by the end of the year, something like 15% versus 20% of Metaculus.
Yeah,
the unlikely, still possible.
Maybe like a peace deal by 2025, you know, if you think a peace deal is pretty attached to taking the land bridge, maybe I sort of guess you might think there's like a 40% chance of a peace deal. And then, you know, you think maybe they keep, and you think probably Russia keeps Crimea and Luhansk and Donetsk in a case of a peace deal. Is that?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I think a peace, So, you know, if Ukraine does cut the land bridge, although I think a peace deal becomes much more likely, I don't necessarily think, I think it's still something like a coin flip. I mean, Putin may agree to that or may not agree to that. And so I don't think it's a certainty. It's just the odds of peace go way up if it happens.
Yeah, I think that's so. I think I've roughly got that. I said that if it happens, if the land bridge gets cut by September, I said 60% chance. If by the end of next year, 50%, And if neither of those, then maybe 20% of a peace deal by 2025.
I think if the land bridge does not get cut, I'm very bullish. I'm not very optimistic on a peace deal.
So maybe like 10%.
I think Putin will wait at least after the next election to see what happens in the U.S. Because I think probably they think Trump will get elected and maybe this will change things. Also, maybe they think that they can outlast the West. And I think that's kind of the... You know, Putin himself has said that this is their goal, to outlast the West, that, you know...
Which, I mean, I think they've been relatively good at in the past, right? This sleddy salami slicing strategy, I think, has been pretty effective.
Exactly. And so there also is, I mean, in defense of this strategy... you know, there's been chat that maybe Ukrainian losses so far are a bit higher than we thought before, some evidence to this. And that if Russia just keeps pounding away, you know, Russia has four times as many people to lose. So this kind of strategy of just kind of long-term death by a thousand blows, it might actually work, you know. And also, while I don't think Trump is going to get elected, there's some probability, some chance he does.
I think probably 35 to 45%, right?
Yeah. It's got to be at least 25% at least. I'm probably a little bit lower than you, but I still think it's probably 30-35%. And in that case, you know, Putin might be well within his rights to try to wait this out and see how things change. So I guess there's the one thing we haven't mentioned that's kind of a big factor, which is interesting and influenced my thinking about this. Is that my original thought was that, you know, Russia will take 2 years to fully mobilize its economy. It'll start producing huge amounts of shells and armaments. And that hasn't happened. It doesn't seem that Russia's spending huge amounts of its GDP on the defense sector. You know, maybe some of this is hidden money. But they haven't really mobilized their economy yet, just like they haven't mobilized their human resources to fight. And so, you know, so you got that on one side. On the other side, you have the Biden administration, which has just been having a take it slow approach. Let's, you know, let's send them 30 Abrams in 6 months. Let's just take small incremental approaches. And so neither side really seems to have the instinct for just to land the knockout blow. And it's a little bit puzzling. I mean, I think... You know, the Biden administration could have sent 300 Abrams immediately instead of 30 Abrams in 6 months. You know, they could have sent 300, strikers and 300 Bradleys instead of 50, you know. And so those are the kinds of numbers that would really move the needle. And so both sides seem to just be underestimating what it takes. The other thing that's come up is that it's just been clear that the West... You know, Western Europe basically demilitarized, more or less. They just don't have the equipment to fight a protracted war. You know, if one Western European country had gotten into a war with Russia and they couldn't rely on the U.S. and NATO, they would have run out of our ammunition in a couple of weeks. That's how long a European power could last. And so, and it's also the case that the West has run out of ammunition to give Ukraine. This is why they're going to the cluster munitions. And even the U.S. Barely has the capability to produce a lot of artillery. And so if Russia did really decide to fully mobilize its economy, then they could do a lot. And so the other thing is that Ukraine...
So just to push back on that, maybe... I mean, so this was a discussion that I had with Stephen. We're looking at sort of Stephen's stuff here, and, you know, this is sort of my understanding of someone else, so, you know, he might not entirely endorse this. But I think most of it's pretty similar to yours. The disagreement is this sort of Russia threat and NATO. He sort of pretty unlikely now that Russia was just going to be any threat to NATO nations for the next 10 years. He sort of, as a result of this, Russia was kind of out of it. And he also sort of brought up that a key point was whether China would supply Russia. I mean, what do you think on those two takes? He was sort of like, yeah, I mean, so maybe the argument from him might, or like an argument I'll make is like, Russia just can't mobilize. Like, it just doesn't have the economy to mobilize. It can't afford to spend loads and loads spinning up new factories. It just isn't doing it already. Whereas the West could, even though if it hasn't, and certainly America, now that it's starting to, will. But that a scary proposition would be if China decided it wanted to throw its weight behind Russia, though you know, then it's, at least you certainly have one geopolitical adversary, not two.
Right. So I don't think that China will provide a bunch of munitions and equipment directly to Russia. But, you know, I think the worry with Russia's economy, if Russia, so Russia hasn't really tried to throw tons of money at this problem yet, and they could because they have oil wealth. If they did, I think they could via parallel imports of parts that they need, right? So there's Russians living all over the world. You know, they tend to be entrepreneurial. The import-export business is something that Russians in a number of countries would do. I even have a former student of mine is in Istanbul these days, who I helped advise on his thesis, and he was actually, his brother is part of the import-export business. They're importing things into Turkey and then sending them to Russia. And so I don't actually think the sanctions will be that big of a deal Russia's development.
You think that if Russia really were to sort of maybe economically mobilize,
they could.
That could be bad.
I think they could absolutely produce a lot more than they're producing. Will they produce? Will they be able to outproduce NATO? No, but NATO's not really mobilizing either. Right? So, you know, the Biden administration, I think they wanted to like double the amount of 155 artillery, or maybe triple, you know, and I think they also want to increase HIMARS, you know, by 50% or something. But to really make a difference, they need to 10x it. And so they're only willing to take baby steps. And so they kind of just thought, oh, by fiddling around a little at the margins of production, we can tilt the war in our favor. No, I don't think so. I think they need to 10x this stuff. Or 20x this stuff to have an impact.
Okay.
I think this instinct of Biden and the Biden administration.
I'm going to jump in now. We're going to do some more lightning stuff. What about the nukes? What about tactical nukes? Do you have opinions on whether that will?
Unlikely. Very unlikely. I think below 5%.
I never find nuclear below 5%. Can you go any lower than that, Doug?
Yeah, right. I mean, 5% is still a lot. I'm going to go for 1%. Obviously, never say never.
Right. Okay. And obviously that would be a tactical nuke. For anyone listening, that's not a nuclear weapon at a city. That's a nuclear weapon on a battlefield, which we are not trained to think of as differently. And maybe it's good that we don't, but it is different. Okay, I think a thing I might like to do, I don't know, I'll give you maybe a final statement on this, and then I would just like to quickly just ask an AI question. But is there anything else that you think we've kind of underrated in this discussion? Anything that you think people don't think about enough?
I think that's pretty good. Not that I can think of now, probably I'll think of something later. But.
So
I guess we haven't discussed a Putin regime change.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, let's have your regime change thoughts.
So I've kind of long been a holder of Putin. Yes, in prediction markets, I did have quite a bit of scare during the Wagner thing, which I did not foresee coming. I think it was very shocking. It ended in kind of also interesting, unexpected way.
Did you buy more yes at that point? Because you had some great yes prices. I mean, things dropped, yeah, I don't know, yeah, to yeah, 70, yeah. 60%.
So I did trade that, not very well. Actually, at first I was buying a bunch of Putin no's to hedge. And then I also bought some more not some good prices on another website where I got very good prices. I was also at the same time buying Putin yeses. Well, I was buying Putin knows on another website just because the price had gotten to a large level. But I'm still net, I guess, I was always a net holder of Putin yes, I would say. But I definitely did get a scare when the Wagner thing started. And I do think that even though I think it's still a yes, so right now it's trading at 90% or so, I do think it's probably worth holding, yes. But I think, you know, the chances are elevated that maybe Prigozhin will go after Putin at some point, or someone will go after Putin at some point.
But I mean, it seems to me like Prigozhin is just so weak now. I mean, he went to see Putin. The early reports from that meeting seemed to say that he wasn't accepting deals, but the men behind him, the other Wagner commanders, were saying, oh, this seems like maybe a good thing. Like, it just seems to me, I mean, I think it looks bad for Putin that anybody managed to get so close to his capital, but I don't understand Prigozhin at all. Like, I just found him to be a man who I still really sort of struggle. I think maybe it looks like he just had less troops than we thought and things just weren't going to work out for him. But then I don't understand why he marched in the first place. He doesn't really make sense to me as a figure.
No, it doesn't. And yeah, I guess it doesn't make a lot of sense to me either. I mean, so some of my friends in Russia who have, you know, contacts in the Russian government, their view was that he never really, you know, wanted to threaten Putin. It was just trying to stage a coup of the Ministry of Defense. But, you know, how was that going to work out for him? You know, it didn't predictably. You know, there was some rumor that some of the FSB had kind of threatened family members of Wagner, people who were just, you know, still in Russia. And so maybe he also realized that it wouldn't, you know, he wasn't going to win.
But
maybe
he
expected
that
more.
I don't know. If I ran a military contractor and sometimes attempted to run coups on my main sponsor, then I might try and get my family and the families of my commanders out of Russia before that I ran a coup.
Sure. Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But then, of course, you know, people who are judging Prigozhin out of all this don't account for the fact that actually in the end, it seems that now Prigozhin is still getting, or his businesses are still getting government contracts. Seems now he's kind of back in a gray zone. He didn't go to jail. He's still alive. So it seemed like he was able to salvage this somehow. And so, you know, what we don't really know that much about is Prigozhin's historical relationship with Putin. Obviously, they know each other very well. The relationship goes back decades. And so, I don't know. But it looked to me like an attempted, not just a mutiny, but an attempted coup was kind of my view. And that, you know, Prigozhin is, at the end, he's a hard-blooded, violent criminal. And so, I mean, I kind of like a lot of his takes, all the criticisms of the war and everything. And so I do think, you know, Putin's playing with fire a little bit, and that Putin has shown weakness by not putting down the Wagner rebellion in its entirety and either killed Prigozhin or sent him to jail. So, you know, before I'd kind of thought that Putin was a pretty good, you know, by the standards of, you know, cruel dictators, you know, before this happened and before the war, I would have rated Putin a lot higher, that he would have cracked down on something like this, clear intransigence. And then he didn't, does suggest that Putin does seem a little bit weak to me. And so I think the chances of a coup are elevated since then until, you know,
do you have a sort of view on, like,
kind of think,
oh, next
I think
year, maybe, you know, Putin to 2025?
You know, I still think it's like Putin at the end of this year should probably, a fair price would be, you know, 97% or 96%, something like this. But then you factor in the fact that, you know, treasuries are now trading. You can probably get 2.5% risk-free on a U.S. treasury. So you're going to want to demand more than 96 cents, or less than 96
cents. But about Putin for 2025, what would you give for that?
I would go about 90%. So the one thing with Prigozhin is, you know, if it doesn't happen soon, it probably won't happen.
I think I'd go lower than that for 2025, but...
Yeah, interesting.
And again, viewers, I remind you that unlike many, Doug, you know, he may not exactly agree with the definitions that I put here, so you have to get it from. But he really is willing to bet. If you've got a couple of hundred, you know, a couple of hundred dollars, I don't know what the minimum amount that people will, but you probably are happy, non-American citizens, not people for whom it's illegal. But if it is legal, then you can just message him and a market can be set up.
Yeah, exactly. If you have any market suggestions or something you'd like to bet on, any propositions, just let me know. Also, I do think people who are just prediction markets on Metaculus, You know, I think it's actually, you know, the first time you bet or anytime you bet, you know, if you put down $5 or $10, I do think it will kind of force you to think a little bit more actively about the market. And I think it's a good thing. You know, so I think, you know, if you have a problem with gambling, you probably shouldn't be betting at all. But I do think it just forces people to think a little more carefully about a market. And then I think also just the fact that, you know, if you're really certain you can put down a lot of money, this should lead theoretically to better prices. I think on Inside Prediction, we probably need more people on the site buying and selling to improve the accuracy of our predictions. But yeah, for all these opinions, you know, if I believe something, it'll be reflected in the odds on our website. So, you know, if you think I'm an idiot, you can come and take my money on Inside Prediction. So,
what is your track record like, Doug? Do you make money on average? Do you lose money on average? Do you make break even? I think I'm about break even. I don't make a lot of money.
I guess from the beginning of Inside Prediction, I'll have to say, providing liquidity, I've lost on average, I think, a fair amount of money providing liquidity. Recently, I think we've done a bit better, but, you know, providing liquidity is tough. And so part of the reason is, you know, we want the website to grow, so we provide liquidity. Providing liquidity in real time for anyone to come and just trade on the news it's a difficult prospect. You kind of expect to lose money providing liquidity to some extent. And some of it might be that my odds are not that good. So, you know, welcome. This history is that people have taken money from Inside Prediction. So, I think, you know, this is just a help market. on the whole, I have made money on other websites. But
so
you know,
don't bet against Doug on other websites, but bet on Doug against Doug here because he's a liquidity provider and he's
exactly.
Okay. As a kind of finisher then, Katia and I tried to make a sort of simplified model which gets kind of people's AI cruxes. So mm-hmm. We're just gonna kind of blitz through to see maybe where you disagree with her on these. So I'm just gonna ask you, just kind of give me your gutsy. You know, I'm not saying that this is going to be that accurate, but I think it would just be interesting to like to hear where you agree or disagree. So, you know, a number and a couple of sentences. So, okay. And also feel free to say, you know, that you think something's missing from this model as we go through. So the first one is like, will we get AI tools that can like run, you know, a department of a national civil service by 2040 with like many, many fewer staff, with 1/100th as many staff? So, you know, this is sort of like, you know, I think in the UK, there's like 400,000 people who work, maybe 40,000 policy professionals. And this is sort of saying that if you had 400 people, you could run the entirety of the UK, sort of the policy side of the UK civil service. You know, is that something, you know, what odds do you put of that existing by 2040?
I guess I'd put it maybe at 15%. We'll see.
Okay.
Can I stop for a bathroom break really quick?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, thank you. Just one second.